Welcome to the Information Security Forum videocast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert, and today we are featuring ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin in conversation with James Arroyo, Director of the Ditchley Foundation. In this conversation, Steve and James discuss growing geostrategic tensions, recognizing reputation as one of the organization's crown jewels, and more.
James, great to see you. Thanks very much for stopping by.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your work, the Ditchley Foundation.
So I've been at Ditchley for about 3 years. Ditchley was set up to support the transatlantic relationship and to use the old term, the West, in the aftermath of the Second World War and at the height of the Cold War. And what I think of us as doing now is to help renew, help revive in some cases, democracy in its broadest sense. Not in a kind of nostalgic way, not in an aggressive way, but how do we take on into the future the things we care about the way our systems run, and how do we fix the things that don't work well? Mm-hmm. And I think the answers to that lie in a combination of government, technology, and finance and business. How do you bring those levers together and, crucially, those people together? Because we think everything is done in the end through people.
No, I'd agree with that, certainly, the people piece. And I think what's very interesting is that we all too often forget about that. So, you know, we get very excited, don't we, about technology. We get very excited about regulation, about the way in which governments interact. And we sometimes lose sight of the people piece. So how do you bring that to the forefront?
Well, I start with kind of fundamentals, which is that people are networked creatures. We have been from the start. Mm-hmm. And we build networks because we are networks. So you can't escape the people. We build networks to connect people together, mm-hmm. Not just for their own purposes. And it's about thinking, I think, you know, who holds an idea? How does an idea actually have impact on the world? It doesn't do anything on its own on the page. Mm-hmm. It only really takes action through the mind of another person. So for me, it's just omnipresent. It's about the people, even if it's about technology.
Right. And so how do you actually deal with some of the challenges that you're facing? I mean, you mentioned government, for instance.
Yeah.
Governments traditionally are not that quick to move, perhaps don't communicate as well as they might with other government institutions. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things we're trying to do is to help people in government understand the importance of technology better.
Right.
Not in the technical sense, they don't need that, but they do need to understand the implications much more clearly. It was widely commented after Mark Zuckerberg was interviewed by the Senate the level of questioning was very poor. Mm. And I think that revealed the lack of understanding from most people in government. If you look at the UK, everyone talks about how our future is in technology. Mm. But when you ask people to specify what that means, often they'll just say faster broadband. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a job of education to be done with governments. At the same time, I think the same is true of technologists.
Right.
It was commented to me once that some technologists have read half the preface of a book on libertarianism, and they're a quick study, so they're done. They've got it. They've worked out how human beings interact. They've worked out how governments could work better, mm-hmm. and it'll all be fine if we can just get the right app. And clearly that's not true either. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of, I think, educating people and bringing people together across these silos of expertise.
And that element of education is hugely important. Probably from a security standpoint, absolutely fundamental, because the way in which we tend to communicate increasingly is digitally, rightly or wrongly. And that opens up, I think, a whole range of possibilities for hackers, cybercrime gangs, and so on, to really access information that I think a lot of people perhaps are unaware that might have value. And so for me, you know, when we talk about education, there is a huge amount of work that needs to go into really helping people understand the value of the information that they are willingly sharing.
Yes, yes.
How we do that, of course, is a different matter.
Mm.
And I think that it does have implications right the way from the individual through to government. Are those the sorts of conversations that you have at Ditchley?
We are having those conversations. I mean, governments have always cared about data from the Doomsday Book onwards.
Yeah.
To know things is to have some power. Mm-hmm. You know who to tax. You know who you need to control. You get a sense of that. What I'm seeing happening is that as this information mounts up, it's turning into a really detailed map of the human world. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have consequences for good. That's going to be fantastic. It's going to allow us to accelerate things. We're going to be able to personalize education and move people forward more quickly. But it's also going to have some negative impacts. I think the other thing that people find difficult to get their heads around is the concept of the networking of information,
right,
and how that provides insights in itself. So you have what you think of as your information and you believe you own it, but actually it only really makes sense in the context of comparison with others or through its relationships with others. What that means is even if you opt out, you're a kind of like little missing piece in the jigsaw and people can identify you. So I think it's getting increasingly hard to opt out of anything, even if you close down your privacy settings. Nonetheless, you're there. Even if by an absence, and that can help people who are trying to target you.
Places a huge responsibility, doesn't it, onto the people who are storing that data.
Yes.
To do the right thing, if you like. And you made a point earlier about, you know, our government's best equipped to understand some of the implications of this. Do you see an environment in the not-too-distant future where we have a much more highly regulated environment? Is that something that you would advocate to protect the individual?
I think we have to be careful about over-regulation.
Right.
I think that could kill innovation, as people claim. So I think we have to be thoughtful about regulation. I think education and self-regulation are really important, trying to think through the consequences of what we're doing with data. And realizing that it could have negative as well as positive impacts is essential. So I don't want to reach directly for regulation, but I think regulation is coming whether we like it or not. And the challenge is going to be making sure that it's the right regulation and not too heavy.
I think one of the other challenges that I see is the difference in the way in which regulation can be imposed or the need for regulation as it's perceived by governments in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the UK, for instance. I think the UK is a relatively liberal in environment, if I could put it that way. Some other parts of the world, perhaps not so much. How do we ensure that we can have a level playing field, if you like, across all of those different geographies? Because at the individual level, once we produce data and we put it up into the cloud or wherever we happen to store it, it's universally available.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good question, a really difficult question, and a huge challenge. We're used to this concept of a multinational company that can set up a series of rules and operate internationally, broadly in a coherent way. I think that's going to come under real pressure.
Right.
And it's going to be felt, actually, around data and information and security really strongly. Because you are going to be dealing with jurisdictions that have wildly different views about what information is private and what isn't, and the respect that should be given to that and that shouldn't be. So that, you know, the European Union at one end and China at the other, how are you going to operate as a company across that spectrum, I think is going to be hard. I think the concept of multinational in terms of people is going to be hard as well, as we see more strategic competition between countries, between the US and China primarily, but others too. So things that we took for granted aren't always going to be so.
Right. And do you have any tips, any advice for security professionals who might be, you know, listening to this and thinking, okay, well, I'm the chief information security officer of a multinational organization. Regulation is an issue for me. I do have operations in different parts of the world. Any advice for those sorts of individuals about how they can deal with this particular challenge?
So I think risks are going to multiply.
Right.
I mean, we can all list them, and your members will know lots of them. Internet of Things, obviously. Mm-hmm. The human factor, as I'm going to focus on. The lack of clarity about AI and mm-hmm. training sets, as I was just hearing about at one of the talks here. Risks are multiplying all over the place. Geostrategic tensions are going to grow. Mm. It's going to be really hard. A complex world is going to get more complex. And people responsible for security are still going to be in charge of that. What to do? I think the crucial thing is to have real clarity about what it is essential to protect. Mm-hmm. If you try and protect everything, you cannot possibly be agile and competitive.
Right.
You'll become slowed down. You will get outcompeted. So you've got to, as a security professional, you really need to understand the core of what your organization stands for. And I mean that not just in terms of protecting the money as a company, for example, but what's the core value? Mm. What's the absolute defining thing about us as an organization? What does our reputation really stand on? That's what you're going to have to protect. And you're only going to be able to protect that because there's going to be lots of threats elsewhere.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. I mean, we talk at the ISF a lot about protecting the crown jewels.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of organizations, that is automatically translated into critical asset management. But you raise reputation as being, one of the fundamental values of an organization. That's exceptionally difficult to protect, isn't it?
But reputation is everything. If you lose some money, then that's bad. It's worse if you lose personal data, mm-hmm. people's personal data, and then they're subject to cyber attacks. That's really bad. But you can make restitution for that.
Right.
If you lose your reputation, you've lost everything. So what is it that you really stand for? That's what you need to organize your systems around, in my view. And I think that would be increasingly the case as the world gets more complex and you have to make hard choices.
And this complexity, of course, is not helped by the fact that we have extended supply chains. We share information with so many different individuals
yeah.
now. And the days are long gone where you could say we had a network perimeter around our corporation where that we could actually, throw a fence
yeah.
up around and protect. So life is going to get more complex, as you point out. Any advice that you can give to boards of organizations who perhaps perhaps a board member's listening to this and he thinks, well, I wonder how we could sort of move into that space. How could we protect our reputation better?
Work with companies that share your values.
Right.
Not the one necessarily that's going to give you the cheapest deal. Because then if they're trying to protect the same thing, mm-hmm. that they want to be the company that stands for this and that aligns with what you stand for, that's the best starting point. Try and choose people who share your values because then your protections will align.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, isn't it? Because now what you're saying is that, you don't necessarily go with the lowest bidder, if you like. You have to take a much more holistic view on value. And you have to be working with people that are like-minded, that are going to be able to assure you that they're doing the right thing within the different contexts that you've just mentioned. And I think for a lot of people, certainly multinationals, certainly in certain parts of the world, that's a very difficult thing to do because it is all about the bottom line.
It is, but the bottom line is going to be affected ultimately by the core of the company. So I'm not suggesting that you always have to do that, but mm-hmm. if you have as this kind of guiding point, what is it we really need to protect? When it comes down to that, you really need to be aligned with other organizations that will take as much care as you do about that. If they're really worried about something else, they will not be looking at the things that threaten you. They'll be facing in another direction. So I think people are going to have to be discerning about this and decide when it's more important to to look to the core of the company and choose that as a basis. We're about to see this this played out with the UK, and I don't know which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. So you're alluding there to technology effectively being used almost as a political football.
Well, I think technology has become political.
Right.
I don't think they're mistaken. I think technology is now at the core of politics, and it always has been. It's just taken a little while for digital technology to mature to the point where it is. Mm-hmm. Post First World War, Second World War, nuclear weapons, which is a technology, became the center of politics for a generation. Mm-hmm. It's taken some growth and some development, but now we're seeing digital technology. And I think particularly AI come right into center focus for the interests of states.
And are governments well enough equipped to make those sorts of decisions? Because you made the point earlier with the Zuckerberg hearings, for instance, that clearly some of the people involved are not up to speed. So where does that leave us?
Well, I think governments are at different points on this. If you look at a certain authoritarian country with a large population in the East, they seem pretty clear on this. Now, there may be downsides to their approach, downsides in terms of the pace of innovation, downsides in terms of growing their economy. But it's going to have some upsides in terms of government access to data, government access to AI. And whether we like it or not, we are going to see these things weaponized and folded into government systems. So I think the Chinese have a very clear policy about achieving supremacy, or at least a peer-to-peer relationship, mm-hmm. with the US on aspects of technology. I think as I look at the US and the West, we're still working it through. There's a tension between our commitment to open innovation and open markets, which I personally strongly believe in, and state access to these technologies. And that's going to take some time. But I think in the end, it's going to be too important for us to step back.
So some very interesting points there for security professionals around how the profession is going to become, I would say, very much more important, have a much more leading role in terms of advising, consulting. Would you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I have a sort of corny thing I occasionally say, which I'll say now, which is that if you look at the Middle Ages, then right. the common, everyone in the UK is called Smith for a reason.
Right.
Because, you know, metalworking was the technology.
Right.
You know, if we were still named after our professions, then, you know, being called cyber or security would be a pretty good equivalent, because it's going to be involved in everything, along with AI, which is this kind of foundational technology, which is powerful because of its limitations, because of its simplicity, but it just makes everything a bit more efficient. So it's going to be seeded, you know, throughout our systems.
James, some fantastic insights there, and plenty, I'm sure, for our listeners to ponder on. So thank you very much for sharing some of those, and really enjoyed our chat.
Well, thanks for having me.
Great.
Good to see you.
We'll be back soon with another conversation. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed this video, please subscribe, rate and review it, and we'd love it if you'd share it in your networks. Please visit securityforum.org to join the conversation on our LinkedIn group and download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance relating to this discussion.